Well, greetings once again to everyone here at TF Metals Report. This is your pal Turd signing in for another edition of A to A, which is short for Access to Access, giving you, the Vault subscriber, access to the access that you have given me. And our guest for this week's program is an old friend. Well, that's not a very nice thing to say. Old in terms of we've known each other now for a while.
We've known each other for a while, yes.
Alistair McLeod. Alistair, who is the head of research at Gold Money. He's also the proprietor of his own site, financeandeconomics.org. And he is a smart cookie. You should definitely be saving both of those sites to your favorites list. Be checking every time Alistair posts something. He just posted something this morning. We're going to discuss it here in a second. But before we get started, Alistair, thank you so much for spending some more time with us. Really appreciate it.
That's very much my pleasure.
My friend, I think we should dive right in. It has been a crazy year so far with gold bottoming, not coincidentally, I would imagine, right when the Fed hiked Fed funds rates back in December. Everybody thought gold was going dramatically lower. Instead, it's up almost 30% since the day they did that. The GLD has seen its alleged inventory rise by more than 50% since the day they did that, December 16th of last year. So we've had prices rising, interest rates falling at the same time. We've got this global NERP. We've got, which now we have negative rates almost across the planet. That's an extraordinarily strong fundamental for physical gold. But what I really wanted to ask you about, my friend, is the stuff you've been writing about for the last week or two about LIBOR and this rising short-term funding costs. We see it in LIBOR. I wrote a thing about the TED spread about a week ago. You wrote about it again this morning. What is that rising LIBOR rate telling you, Alistair, and what should we be on the lookout for here as we barrel through the remainder of 2016?
Well, the story which people keep on telling us is that the reason that LIBOR is strong is because of changes in regulations for the margins in money market funds. Money market funds that invest in prime debt are going to have to carry a different margin, a higher margin, than those that invest in government securities. So what it's done is it's encouraged a number of big funds to move over from lending to prime borrowers to lending to the US government. So there is a shortage of money market funds sourced loans in the LIBOR market. That is the story. But if you actually look at what's happened to LIBOR, it has been rising for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so this is just, you know, not the whole story. It is only a small part of it. But I've tied it in with something else. If you take M2 money supply, which is broad money, and you subtract M1, which is narrow money, which basically is base money plus a few bits and pieces, you end up with a reasonable proxy for bank lending. Now, what's happened recently, and particularly since July the 11th, is that bank lending has rocketed upwards. So what we have is we have got, if you like, money market rates considerably higher than the Fed funds rate, and you have money supply taking off. Now, that tells me that money is actually going into the non-financial economy, if you like, the broader economy. And that being the case, in the bad old days when they didn't do special measures or anything like that, any decent FOMC member would have looked at the expansion of bank lending, looked at the pressure for interest rates to rise, and think to himself, hold on a minute, we are going to have inflation down the road. And what's fascinating is, I mean, you just tie those two things together, that's all you need know. But what's fascinating is I did a word search of the FOMC minutes of the end of July, which were released last night. And I look for LIBOR, no mention of LIBOR at all. I look for M2, no mention. M1, no mention. Bank lending, there was one sort of mention about a bank lending officer's survey, but nothing about how bank lending is actually progressing. So, in other words, we have all those pages of FOMC minutes, and they're not looking at the thing that matters. It is actually extraordinary, and I think it is actually disgraceful that they're not watching the one thing they should be watching, giving them advance warning that, you know, this money, which is all parked in excess reserves on the Fed's balance sheet, is beginning to shift. And indeed, I mean, only $150 billion has come out over the last few months. And $150 billion, of course, by the time you gear it up through fractional reserve banking, you know, you can easily see where the excess bank lending is coming from. And that's very modest gearing. There's another $2 trillion to come out of there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they've got to do something about this. But their problem is that if they raise rates by very much, enough to stop inflation, let's say, moving towards 4 or 5%, then they're going to create yet another credit crisis because of the enormous amount of debt that's overhanging the economy.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're running out of road, and it's just very interesting that here we are, we're in a situation which is so similar to a situation 45 years ago when Nixon closed the gold window. You know, the gold at that time was what, $43 an ounce, I think, on the day after he closed the gold window. It ran over the 1970s up to $800 an ounce. From one fix, it was $850. That was the absolute top. And why did gold run? Gold ran because the Fed was always behind the curve in raising interest rates. And the problem then is the same problem that we will have now. As they raise interest rates, unemployment will rise, prices will rise at the same time. It is called stagflation. The setup is so similar, it's uncanny.
Are we all going to be getting those whip inflation now buttons again, Alistair? Is that where we're headed?
Well, stagflation, I think, is actually quite easy to understand. You've only got to look at people changing their preference en masse against money and in favor of goods. We're not really talking about buying more goods. We're talking about getting rid of money before its purchasing power goes down. And that time is coming back, I'm afraid.
Yeah. You know, if we look back at that period of the 70s, yeah, it was high inflation and interest rates weren't rising fast enough. And as you mentioned, the gold price surged and it was a rather miserable time. We've been talking about that potential really since 2011, when all of this money printing, just from whole cloth, took over by all these global central banks, whether it was the Fed or the ECB or the Bank of Japan or whomever. And it hasn't happened yet. And a lot of folks cite the velocity figures, you know, which you've seen those Fred charts where the velocity just keeps going straight down. And the fact that all of that stuff has been somewhat quarantined in the excess reserves, is that what you're seeing now? Do you anticipate just the extra flushing of dollars out and euro out and yen out into creating much larger money supply? Or do you think there actually might be an uptick in the velocity to go with it?
I think that you've got to look at that, I think, in a slightly different way. Okay. Let's look at the overall scene. We can see that money is beginning to go into the basic economy. So far, it hasn't really been going into the economy. It's just been going into buying assets, you know, sort of financial assets of one sort or another. Now it's beginning to go into the economy. But this contrasts very, very starkly with the complete lack of any economic recovery and indeed the threat that the economies are going to go into a slump in Japan and also in Europe. So what does the Fed do? Can it raise rates when everything else is in a slump? And the problem is that as Europe goes into a slump, you've got the banking crisis potential from Italy, from Portugal, and some of the larger banks there are basically bust. It's the only way to describe it with any modicum of truth. So, you know, do you aggravate that situation by raising rates now? The answer is you probably don't, because you don't want to sort of upset everything. And also the other problem you've got is China. On the last occasions when the Fed has prepared the markets for a small rise in the Fed funds rate, what happens is that the Chinese come in, they devalue their currency,
right.
They change all the assumptions in the Fed's computer models, and the Fed has to back off. We don't really know why the Chinese are doing this. But what we do know is that if interest rates start rising in America, then you are probably getting towards the end of the bond bull market, and you are probably going to see a very substantial move downwards in bond prices. China has I can't remember what the figure is, but I mean it's trillions of U.S. treasuries. They're going to lose an awful lot of money if that's the case. So we don't know how they're going to react if the Fed starts trying to raise interest rates because of the inflation effect that I've just detailed between LIBOR and bank lending.
Yeah.
So if I can go back to a parallel with the 1970s, we have a very difficult situation today. In the 1970s, they had a very difficult situation as well. It was a different one. What was happening was that OPEC was pushing up the price of oil by multiples. And, of course, that was going to have an enormously recession on the West. And so this dissuaded the Fed from trying to tackle the inflation problem. Instead, it tried to keep control over the unemployment problem. So, different times, different problems, but basically the same problem.
Well, and here's where I'm trying to square then, Alistair. You mentioned LIBOR going up almost for 2 years now, gradually, but now a little more sharp here recently. You just wrote about it this morning. What do you show LIBOR at currently?
Well, it's around about 0.8%.
Okay. Now, we figure that as
That's a three-month LIBOR, by the way. The one-year LIBOR is around about 1.5%.
Okay. Then I look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury being at 1.5%. I look at the 10-year German Bund being at 0%. I look at the 10-year Swiss, call it a treasury, 10-year Swiss bond being negative 50 basis points.
Yeah.
And I think, how can we have 90-day short-term funding at 100 basis points, and in Europe, 10-year debt at negative yields? How do those things coexist? And that, any traditional Keynesian measure, an inverted curve like that, is a precursor to recession and an economic downturn.
Well, it is complete lunacy. The reason that prices are where they are is because of central bank intervention. Not only do they intervene in interest rates, which they've been doing for a long time, but they're now intervening directly into the market by buying bonds and creating an artificial shortage in the bond market. So, no price that has anything to do with the central banks is real anymore.
Right. So what happens then, Alistair? I mean, because the central banks, especially the ECB and the Bank of Japan, seem hell-bent on just continuing to buy, and now even the Bank of England. And they just continue to buy every bit of sovereign debt and now even corporate debt and junk bonds and equities and anything they can get their hands on, pushing all that stuff into this skewed reality. But you've got LIBOR and maybe pushing money supply out, which would be pushing inflation. And again, then the other factor is all these derivatives that these banks hold. And all the bonds that these banks hold at 0% and 1%, that would see the derivatives blow up if rates spike a couple hundred basis points. You see the bonds crash in value if rates spike a couple hundred basis points. It's just almost impossible for my little turd brain to figure out where this all heads rationally.
I think the only thing I can say is all of the above. I mean, you're spot on. It is frightening. I don't know if any of your subscribers saw that little scam in Ireland, where the Bank of Ireland, which owned an insurance company, manufactured some credit for the insurance company so the insurance company could lend it back to the bank to make the balance sheet look good. I mean, complete fraud. Now, the chief executive of the Bank of Ireland has actually, is found guilty of fraud. Now, I just wonder to what extent those games are being played on the European continent. Exactly. I should think all the time.
Writ large.
You know, I mean, the standard banking, European banking model is you have a bank, you have an insurance company, you have pension funds, and so on. So you've got all these entities where you can use other people's money to bolster your balance sheet. Now, I mean, the guys in Ireland were caught out. I doubt if anyone's really trying to catch out anyone in, say, Germany or France on these matters. I should think they're turning a blind eye to it.
Yes.
I bet that is a problem. You know, inevitably, when a bank goes belly up, I mean, you know, you see that it's just passed some sort of stress test, which the ECB or whoever has just announced. You know, it's passed with flying colours. Next thing, the bank is bust, and you wonder, how on earth did that happen? It is just absolutely extraordinary, because there is so much, I suppose, inherently fraudulent behaviour going on within the financial system. And that, if you like, is a legacy of the Lehman crisis, when banks were just encouraged not to value things properly. You know, if something was going to eat into your margins because it was going to be marked to market, what you did was you changed it to mark to myth.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and how much of that stuff is still marked to myth? Right. I mean, these, you know, the bank balance sheets are in pretty bad shape over in Europe. I'm not going to talk about the United States. I'm sure there's a bit of that goes on there as well. But I think at least in the United States, the Fed has placed a greater emphasis on trying to get the banks to rebuild their capital since the Lehman crisis. Nothing like that has been done in Europe at all.
So, Alistair, there's really no way. I just, as you put all this together, I don't see any way that if there is economic growth and activity that and this lending increases and money actually goes out, there's no way, frankly, even that the central banks can allow it, because then they would be forced to try to raise rates to control, like you said, be behind the curve as they were in the 70s. And any move up in interest rates is only going to further stress their member banks around the world. And if those banks get stressed and their derivatives become in question, their balance sheets become in question, the banks are just going to have to simply print more money, support yes. every bank from Monte Paschi to Credit Suisse to Deutsche Bank to anything at risk in the U.S. And the thing only just continues to get exacerbated. I'm with you. I don't see how this works out really any other way.
Well, it's slightly worse than you say, because the experience – The experience that the central banks had in the wake of the Lehman crisis was they could print money like billio, and there was no inflationary effect at all, at least no recorded inflationary effects as per the CPI. So next time there's a real banking crisis and they've got to go out and rescue the banks, which they will, they'll rescue them. I mean, the banks aren't going to go bust. They'll just rescue the banks. They'll do it by printing as much money as is needed, you know, whatever it takes, as Mr. Draghi has famously quoted. And they don't actually understand the dynamics behind price inflation. The situation is different, and this is why what LIBOR is telling you is LIBOR is telling you that the market is pricing money at a far higher level than the Federal Reserve Board. And so with the price of money already higher than what the Fed's, sort of paying the bank's reserves on its balance sheet, you can see that plus the growth that we've now got going in bank lending, if you like, you know, the bank lending component of M2, you know, inflation is coming back. It's being fed into the system, probably at a faster rate than anybody actually understands at the moment. It is an inherently very dangerous and very difficult situation. And what amazes me is that the FOMC is completely oblivious to this. There was nothing in the minutes. As I say, I did a word search. There's nothing in the minutes about LIBOR or about bank lending, M2, M1. It was quite extraordinary.
And if you were a U.S. bank sitting on billions of excess reserves with LIBOR where it is, why would you continue to let the Fed pay you 25 basis points or 50 or whatever it is on your excess reserves when you can loan it out now and get 100 basis points, right?
That's a very interesting question, because really, whether you do that or do not do that depends on why people are borrowing money. Now, if they're borrowing money because they're seeing that the sunny uplands of economic expansion and the world is now full of opportunities and we've got to go out and lend money to the new thrusting youngsters who've got these wonderful new business ideas, that's one thing. If, on the other hand, you've got to dip into your reserves so that you can build, do a bit more bank lending to those customers of yours whose inventory is slowing down, who are finding that they've got to lay off staff, who are finding that they can't quite, cover their cash flow, then you're actually lending as a bank for a different reason. You're trying to stop bad debts arrive on your balance sheet. Now, I don't know which of those is true. It's probably a mixture of the two. But, we've now got a situation where bank lending is increasing for whatever reason. And, you've got to make a choice as a central bank. Either inflation matters, price inflation matters more than unemployment, or unemployment matters more than inflation. And I think that they're going to choose the latter. I think they're going to say that, we don't want, particularly in a presidential election year, you don't want to see unemployment rising. You don't want to hit the economy with higher interest rates. So, the very least that you're going to do is probably sit pat rather than raise rates.
Yeah.
And they don't actually understand what is happening under their noses to money. It is completely unbelievable. I mean, if 10 years ago someone had told me, do you know what, the central banks are going to completely ignore the relationship between the quantity of money and the effect on prices somewhere down the road, I would say, come on, don't be ridiculous. But that's what's happening.
Yeah. Sounds to me, like you said, that is the recipe for 1975 to 79. It's a recipe for what we saw in all commodities from really 2009 through 2011. Sure makes you wonder how the rest of this year and next is going to play out. Alistair, I'll put a link on this page to what you just put out this morning, and anybody that wants to kind of continue their thought process along those lines, I encourage everybody to click it and read it and continue to follow Alistair through the Gold Money site and through his financeandeconomics.org site. Alistair, I probably better, though, I'm hogging all your time. We're already 20 minutes into it, and though I could sit and talk about this all day, I'd probably better move on. I've got one question that was emailed into me, and I've already got questions piling up in the queue. Again, if you've got any questions for Alistair, click the on your control panel from GoToWebinar on your screen. Just click the questions tab and type it in, and I will relay it to him. So, Alistair, if you don't mind, I'm going to move on to the question I had emailed to me, if that's all right.
Yes, absolutely. Go for it.
This comes from a site regular, goes by the name Jay Quest. And he just saw something on the SRS Rocco site. Steve has brought in a guy to work with him. I guess he's been a metals analyst and strategist for years by the name of Tom Cloud. And I haven't seen this myself, but Jay Quest has. Says Tom Cloud says that there is a potential change coming to, I guess we'll call it global Muslim law. I mean, the only thing I'm familiar with Muslim law, are these fatwas and stuff. But he says there's a change coming in Muslim law that's going to allow Muslims to own gold. I didn't know that they couldn't own gold in the first place. Maybe invest in gold. Heard anything about that? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I know all about it. Basically, the World Gold Council has developed an initiative whereby it's working with Sharia scholars to ensure that various gold products are compliant with Sharia law. There's going to be a big launch of this by the World Gold Council in Dubai, and I think it's around about the 14th of November. I shall be there.
So this is gold products.
Really? Yeah, it's sort of, investment products. I mean, GLD, right, for example.
Right.
Okay. We're going through the process of looking at this as well. I think that there are quite a number of banks with different gold investment products that want to ensure that they're Sharia compliant. I mean, we're talking about a very big market. I mean, the Muslim market is about 1.7 billion people.
And the thing would be that it's, and I'm just guessing, but I know that there's a usury issue within Sharia law and the Muslim faith. And so the investment products probably can't have, you know, interest components to it and that kind of thing. Maybe that's what they're trying to ensure that that they don't have.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to structure the products in such a way, as you rightly say, that it doesn't conflict with the sort of Sharia law with respect to usury. Also, you've got to be careful that when it comes to ownership, when you buy something, you know, if let's say you're going to buy an investment, you've got to make sure that there is nothing in there which is not direct property ownership. So things like, you know, options and futures and so on and so forth become very, very difficult.
Right.
And, you know, when it comes to paying out dividends, you don't pay dividends, you share in the profits of a scheme. So you have to really sort of set the thing up in such a way that the scholars are happy that it doesn't conflict with the Quran.
Interesting.
And it's quite this is something that we've been doing in London for actually quite a long time with quite a number of different products. But as always, I mean, I think there is a little bit of, if you like, practicality involved with the Muslim world and money. You know, they don't seem to mind too much having a bank account and being probably paid interest. If that is a problem, then you have your bank account with an Islamic bank who will pay you, you know, some sort of profit or something for you, you know, depositing your money. So, yeah. You know, it's just a different way of doing things in a sense. You've got to sort of take about four or five steps round to ensure that what you're doing is compliant rather than just saying, you know what, Craig, I'll just lend you some money. You pay me some interest.
Right.
You can't quite do that.
Well, and obviously we're all proponents of physical gold, but gold and all gold-related investments all kind of flow the everything in the same direction. And so that's certainly encouraging, Alistair. Tell me again, this is going to be in Dubai and when?
Yeah, I think it's slated for about November the 14th, something like that. There is I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but there's an outfit called AOFI, which is the Accounting and Auditing Financial Institutions in the Islamic World, or something like that. So it's them, the World Gold Council, and I think the World Bank may be involved as well. So this is a top level, a top level, you know, sort of compliance thing with Sharia, and it's going to open up potentially gold investment to a very large number of people. I mean, a lot of these people are already investing in gold. I mean, don't get me wrong. Gold ownership is actually quite simple as far as they're concerned. But it's, you know, the other things that spin off it. I think that it will be, you know, quite a good positive for the gold price.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, the GLD may be kind of a sham and not really have all of the gold they say to hold, but man, if all of a sudden another 500 metric tons of demand for the GLD emerges next year, specifically from the Muslim world, at least going to be reported upon. Whether they actually acquire the gold is a whole other thing, but at least be reported upon as, oh, look at all these flows into the gold ETF, that kind of thing. So.
Well, there is an aspect of this which actually is also another positive, and that is that I can tell you that the procedures that the Sharia people go through in terms of establishing how something like GLD works, you know, they want to see an enormous amount of detail about, you know, how each transaction works, you know, how the gold is stored, is there any intermediary situation, you know, they'll have gone into that in great detail. So in a sense, if it becomes Sharia compliant, I think that should satisfy quite a lot of people that GLD actually isn't the scam that everybody's been saying.
maybe they'll take a couple of imams and put blindfolds on them like they did Bob Pisani and drive them in circles for a couple of hours.
That won't work. That won't work, I can tell you. But, I mean, having said that, I would still recommend that you're far better depositing your gold with us at Gold Money.
Yeah, exactly.
but then I'm in competition, so
no, take that. I hear you. Buy gold at Gold Money and Big Gold instead, but that's a whole other story. Okay, let's move on. I've got, like I said, the 6 or 7 questions waiting for you. So we'll try to move through these kind of quickly. Larry wants to know if you expect anything from the G20 in early September or this SDR inclusion of the yuan at the end of September.
That is a fascinating question, Larry. What do I expect out of G20? It's really, I think it's a geopolitical question because you've got China who's going to be hosting this thing. You've got, and this is interesting also in the context of the FOMC committee. You know, I mean, they've been stiffed by the Chinese every time they've tried to raise the rates in the past. So there's going to be an interesting conversation, I think, obviously not amongst the finance ministers, but amongst the central bankers who attend about interest rate policy. I think what's going to come out of it is that China is going to continue to press for her currency to be used more and more for trade purposes. She will only really agree to anything that the US tables so long as the US doesn't produce objections or put obstacles in the way of the yuan becoming more and more accepted. I think also what might become a little more visible will be China's plans at infrastructure development across Asia. Now, what I wouldn't rule out is that China turns around and says to the other G19 members, look, we are going to be spending a lot of money developing infrastructure across the Asian continent. We think that what you should do is you should also have a new deal and spend money on improving your infrastructure and so on and so forth. And by the way, if you want help from us in doing it, we will be only too pleased to talk about it. So that I think it's going to be that sort of thing. And what might come out of it is a feeling that fiscal policies are going to start taking over a bit more from monetary policies. I wouldn't rule that out at all, and I think it's quite likely.
Okay. And this idea about the any impact on gold as we move through September, or do you think it's just more of a
I don't see this having any impact on gold as such. I think it's the interest rate story with the Fed that to me is the fascinating thing. Yeah. I mean, it could be that the Fed sees this, they didn't include this in the minutes, and they think, hold on a minute, there's an arbitrage going on with banks not taking our 0.5%, but instead taking their reserves off the balance sheet and lending it into the commercial market via LIBOR. We have got to catch up with LIBOR, so we will put up interest rates by 0.25% to try and dampen that down. I wouldn't rule that out at all, but I don't think you're going to get very much more than that. And the other thing is that once this October deadline, when the new regulations come in, what's going to happen to LIBOR then? You know, if the people who think it's just this sort of temporary thing, LIBOR will fall back. If, on the other hand, as I argue, you look at the evidence of the growth in bank lending, then I think what LIBOR is telling us is that actually the rates in the commercial world are quite a bit higher than in the central banking world.
Yeah. All right. I'm gonna, as I look at this next question, I can't help but kind of I have to almost have to include my own opinion in this, so I'll ask it and try not to prejudice your answer by including my own opinion. There is a movement afoot. It comes up. It's come up quite a few times the last few months. There are subscription writers that attempt to frighten people and get attention by suddenly becoming experts in the Cott report and the positioning on the COMEX. Most recent being the snake oil selling Harry Dent, who I have a real burn myself for and have had for over 20 years. Anyway, old Harry tried to convince everybody last week that suddenly, because he, as he reads the Kott report, I guess he's an expert, gold is positioned to go down. Now, we've monitored this since February, and my position is if the banks were going to wash and rinse the specs, they would have done it by now, but other conditions are keeping them from doing it. But Ted would like to know your take on the current Kott structure, if you have one.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've actually summed it up quite well. I mean, the way in which it works is quite simple. The bullion banks go short when the hedge funds come in and buy gold. And generally, if they hold their nerve, there will come a point where they can then start bashing the price because the hedge funds don't like making losses. They don't, you know, they're trend chasers. Once they see that, you know, it's peaked and it's going down, they all flood out and, you know, then you just mark it down very, very heavily and you can pick up the contracts that you sold to them in the first place at a very nice, fat, easy profit. They do that. They've been doing that consistently for the last 3 or 4 years. This time it feels really rather different, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the makeup, I mean, this, if you like, is anecdotal information rather than statistical. But if you look at the makeup of the hedge fund buyers in the market, suddenly instead of seeing the trend chasers, you're beginning to see quite a lot of managed funds who are interested in or looking to take a strategic position in gold for portfolio purposes. Mm-hmm. They now realize that the price of gold has moved up by something like 25 to 26% in dollars. It's moved 40% in sterling, by the way, for what it's worth. And silver has moved up something like 40% in dollars, and I suppose it's something like 60% in sterling. So they have been the best performing assets in 2016. And guess what? None of the conventional investment management businesses like pension funds, insurance companies, mutual funds, none of them had any gold whatsoever. They have got to have some. And that is why we have seen the tonnage of GLD rise. And I think a lot of these institutions, they don't look at the paper market and think, oh, hold on, this is risk. No, all they want is exposure to the price, and they will do it through the paper market. And if you've got a good futures broker, you can do it actually without any real cost. I mean, certainly a lot less cost than holding GLD, which taxes you something like 0.4-0.5% per annum. So I think we've seen a different sort of speculator. The speculators are not so much speculators, but long-term investment funds trying to take a strategic position. And I'll give you one very, very good instance. Only this week, Jacob Rothschild, Lord Rothschild, as he is now, who is chairman of RIT, which is Rothschild Investment Trust, announced that in the period up to end June, they have increased their exposure to gold to 8%. Now, that I find fascinating because that is the sort of fund I'm talking about. Yeah. We are seeing this. We are seeing this interest develop from, sort of investment vehicles. In this case, we're talking about an investment trust. You know, you've got unit trusts over here, which is another form of mutual fund, if you like. They are all, they have all lost out by not having any allocation to gold at all. They're looking at, having sort of missed out on that, and they're also looking at the complete failure of monetary policy and wondering whether it would actually be a very good idea to just have a little bit of insurance, like 5 to 10% in gold. So this demand, I think, is actually quite real. And getting back to the nub of the question about the Kott numbers, that you don't see in the commitment of traders figures, and that is why I think that the relationship between the speculators and the producers and all the rest of them, basically the bullion banks, it has fundamentally changed.
And again, this is where you get a fool like Dent trying to make himself into a COMEX expert. You're getting just part of the picture, and you don't know. We know. Let's put it this way. I know personally that These banks maintain offshore hedge fund accounts that are listed as spec. And so you don't know what the bank actually holds and what their net position is. And you're only getting one side of the picture with the COMEX. You have no idea what they hold in London or in some of these offshore OTC markets. And so to just simply look at the cotton, oh boy, historically, man, again, it's a different world. So anyway, I apologize, Alistair. And you're being extraordinarily generous with your time. We're already at the point where I told you we'd go at 40 minutes. I really.
I'm happy. Don't worry.
Let me see if I.
I don't want to bore your subscribers.
I can assure you they're not. But I've got a handful of questions left. I'll try to kind of lump some of them together. There's a couple about Bit Gold and gold money. I'll save those to the end. So let me go here. A guy named Scott wants to know if we do get a point where gold simply resets overnight, you know, whether that comes out of China or whatever, to, you know, a multiple of where we are, $3,000, $4,000 an ounce, whatever. What will happen in the next days, weeks, and months to mining stocks? can you guess how that would play out?
Well, I think, it depends on the mining stock. Not if it's sure. A junior.
Yeah.
If it's junior, I mean, it's like winning the lottery. Yes. I think it's as simple as that. I wouldn't buy mining stocks on the basis that there's going to be an enormous reset. I don't think that it's in the interest of any central bank to see that. I think what central banks could quite easily live with is an increasing price of gold, maybe gold going up in an orderly market, if I can put it that way, to $2,000 or $3,000. Much beyond that, I think there would be some very big alarm bells ringing about, right. Hold on a minute, what's this telling us? Should we have looked at LIBOR and bank lending back in July,
yeah,
2016? I think that as long as it goes up in an orderly market, it won't be too much of a problem. There is another aspect to this, and that is that China and Russia, as you know, have got substantial levels of gold. I mean, we know what pretty well what the public have in China. I think the public have accumulated something between 12 and 15,000 tons of gold. The state has also accumulated a lot of gold. I mean, they're now the largest miner in the world. They brought in regulations, basically appointing the Bank of China to handle the government's gold interests back in 1987. So the state accumulated what gold it really needed, apart from mine supply, between 1987 and 2002, at which point they allowed the public to start buying. So you can see, we don't know how much the Chinese have got.
Yeah.
But if somebody turned around and told me they've got $10,000-$20,000 tons, I would say, well, that's not surprising. I think the Russians have got a lot more than they're saying for the very similar reason. But what this means is there is a geostrategic issue, and that is that if, let us say, America tries to get funny over gold and ends up driving up the gold price, then they are transferring wealth, if you like, from themselves. And we don't know how much gold the Fed's got because it hasn't been audited since, I don't know, since Noah, really.
Yeah.
and they'll be transferring that wealth to Russia and China.
Yeah.
And they can't actually do anything about it, because if they try and do anything and it disturbs the market, they just play into China and Russia's hands. And in a sense, it resolves a problem for China and Russia, because the one thing China doesn't want to do is to destabilize Western markets. If, on the other hand, America destabilizes Western markets, then that's not a problem for China.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
No.
They don't want to get blamed for it. But
yeah.
America, she could. I know I'm talking to a lot of Americans, but I hope you'll forgive me for saying that your government can walk around with some pretty clumsy feet,
yeah,
treading on people's toes and kicking things which they shouldn't be kicking.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, I don't think they can do anything about a rising gold price, which makes me quite, sort of Well, I sort of, you know, I never say never, but I think there's not a lot they can do. But of course, when things do get difficult, there is absolutely no accounting for the stupidity of politicians. And I'm not just talking American politicians. I can tell you politicians anywhere.
Yeah, that's a good point too, Alistair. To that mining share point, I guess, the next question comes from Carl, who just wants to know what you make of the Swiss National Bank. You know, they've been there. What do they own? $1 billion worth of Apple. I mean, for God's sake, Alistair, the Swiss, the paragon of conservative monetary policy for centuries, now owns $1 billion in Apple. But anyway, they also now own a rather large portfolio of mining shares. Given what they've done to their gold supply and leasing it all out, given what they did in almost rigging that referendum 2 years ago, what do you make of the fact that the Swiss National, I mean, are they just in it for profit? Do you make anything out of the fact that they own all these mining shares now?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question, this. I think we're really talking about the politics in a central bank. There's no doubt in my mind that what the Swiss National Bank has done is it's decided that the Swiss francs that it prints, if you like, to try and keep a lid on the purchasing power of the Swiss franc, they will spend the proceeds as if the central bank itself was a sovereign wealth fund. So that I think basically is what they're doing. With respect to gold, of course, there is another aspect. They've sold off all their gold a hell of a long time ago. They've still got some gold. I don't know how much, but they've sold a lot of it over the time, and you know, very stupidly, as it turns out. And it's just interesting that, you know, because the Western central banks are trying very hard to deny that gold is money in any form, the Swiss central bank has pretty well gone along with it. I guess because the central bankers in the Swiss Central Bank basically went to the same universities as the other central bankers. Mm-hmm. And so in a sense, the Swiss National Bank can't be seen to be buying gold. But what they can do is they can hand it over to a portfolio manager and say, right, you know, you've got X billion dollars coming in this month, go and invest it. And the portfolio manager will go and invest it where he thinks fit. And if the portfolio manager thinks that mining shares are the place to be, that's what happens. I know it sounds absolutely crazy, the Swiss National Bank having sold gold over the years, now they're buying mining shares. But I think that's the reason why it's worked like that.
Yeah, no, and that's what we continue. That's all part of why they're up so strongly and they're going to keep going. You know, these guys see they're looking for that proverbial alpha from someplace. And they go out and try to get it. Hey, I've got one more question. And then I mentioned I had two questions about gold money. I accidentally deleted one. So I've still got the one from David. But if whoever out there sent me the other one that's not named David, can you type it back in? Okay. This is kind of a Lost Mind has a question for you. Isn't that a great name? Lost Mind says, Alistair, you just do great work. All kind of these experts out there. Okay, thank you, Carl, for sending that in. All kinds of experts out there talking about total destruction of the current system and currency reset and all this kind of stuff. Some of them will try to convince you that it's, you know, coming tomorrow. Whether or not you think this will actually happen in the next 3 to 10 years, and if it does happen, is it really a big loss for the standard of living of you know, the West? Can you tie all that together if that's something that you think is coming?
Yeah, actually, it's a fascinating question because of the second part of it. This has been coming, I think, for about the last 80 years. And whether it's going to actually sort of arrive in the next 10 or whatever, we really don't know. All I do know is that we're heading into a stagflationary period, and it depends how that plays out. My guess is that it's far more likely to have to end up in a collapse of purchasing power of paper currencies. Now, whether it's rather like the peso, that there's a, you know, the collapse goes on and on and on and on and on and on for 10, 15 years, I really don't know. We can't know. But I do think that paper currencies are going to have enormous difficulties. But the other thing I find fascinating is that when we talk to people in the World Bank or the IMF or in central banks, and we tell them what we're doing with BitGold gold money, which we've rebranded as Gold Money Personal, by the way, they're absolutely fascinated. They're fascinated on two levels. First of all, obviously, the fintech thing, which is a subject of great interest in central banks, but also from the point of view that we're actually sort of making gold useful as money rather than money to spend rather than money to hoard, and they're very interested in that. They think there's actually some sort of mileage there. Now, whether they're looking at it as a supplement to what they're doing or whether they're looking at it as an escape route if they actually do blow the whole thing up, I think depends on which central banker you're talking to. But certainly, I think it is true to say that we are closer to that point. The second thing that you mentioned, which I find a very interesting thing, is a sort of, I don't know if I got this right, but you were sort of almost saying, well, who cares if all this stuff goes anyway? I think it's an extremely good point. It's obviously very uncomfortable facing the change that all this implies in our money. I mean, a lot of people are going to lose an awful lot of real, assets, wealth, if you like. That's going to be a real problem. But having said that, that apart, we get on with life. I mean, it's interesting. I'll tell you a brief parallel. I mean, Brexit. We were all told how if we voted for Brexit, the economy would crash and, all this interest rates have to go up and all the rest of it. And today we had, and this is a month after Brexit, We had a report on consumer spending. Consumer spending increased more than anybody thought in the last month. So that's what Brexit did. It actually didn't interfere with anything that we do. I can tell you the roads here are still packed with traffic, people going here, there, everywhere, white vans, with builders and plasterers and all the rest of it, tractors with farmers, it's life goes on. Life does go on. That's the point. And this is the point that everybody misses about money. Money is actually just the thing for, you and I make something, we need to sell it. We use money to sell it because we take that money to go and buy other things. We don't want the money, we want the other things. And so we will disrupt, with a collapsing fiat currency, we will disrupt that process. Of that, there is no doubt. But the idea that fiat currency is the be all and end all of modern civilization is complete nonsense.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, it's not as bad as what everybody would think. It would be ugly, but
it would be very ugly. It would be very ugly, and actually, because nobody is prepared for it.
Right.
You think of all the elderly, sort of rely on a state pension.
Right.
The state pension is going to be completely worthless.
Right.
And what these people do, they're going to be, anyone who's got anything left over out of this wreckage is going to have to be pretty charitable to their neighbors for the sake of, society or social peace or one's own existence. Well, it could be very nasty, actually, from that point of view.
Like they're saying in Venezuela, you could 1 ounce of silver buys 6 months of groceries at this point.
Oh, I would think at least, absolutely.
If you don't have it.
If you don't, no. It's always the poor that suffer, actually. Yeah. And this is the point which I think is so bad about monetary policy, which debases the currency. It is always the poor that suffer. And that's this sort of relationship between the very rich and the poor, and it's never been so wide in the past and all the rest of it. It's got nothing to do with the fact that the rich are sort of out there being successful capitalists or whatever. It's actually got more to do with the fact that the central banks devalue. They take wealth from the poor, and they transfer it to the banks. And to the bank's close, close customers, who generally are big business, and it's the poor that pay for it.
Exactly. They devalue all of the poor savings. That's why it's only gotten worse in the last 40 years. And all these freaking politicians, Alistair. They all sit there and they want to blame the other politicians so they can perpetuate their power. Nobody ever comes out and says, no, what this really the problem is, the unlimited power of the central banks to debase the currency.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
All right. Let me get that over. Okay. All right. Finally.
Calm down.
Let's talk about how – let's take a second and talk. I love your company. Obviously, I have the utmost respect for you and Mr. Turk and John Butler and all the folks that are involved. Anything that takes gold out of the banker's hands in allocated form and gets it into the people's hands and forces these banks to delever and complicates their issue and perpetuating their schemes, I love it. Tell everybody, before I ask you these questions about gold money, sell it for about 30 seconds, would you, Alistair? Tell everybody how great it is from the inside.
Well, I mean, everything you've said about the people, with the exception of me, I would have to say, they are wonderful people, and they're pursuing a mission which is very, very close to my heart, which is why I'm very happy to be involved with it. But I'd like to just tell you a little anecdote, actually, because I mentioned Brexit. I was on holiday in Canada when Brexit happened, and when I got on the aeroplane, which was about a week before Brexit, the sterling price of gold was, I think, something like £740 an ounce. Now, I obviously have a BitGold account. It's now called a Gold Money personal account. And before I left, I made sure that I had some gold in that account. And also I had my normal bank debit cards. So I tended to spend off the debit cards until Brexit came along. We had the surprise result. And amazingly, the price of gold shot up from that 750-ish level to over 1,000. Now, what I then did was I thought, you know, because sterling also went down. So, you know, most people in my position, having not had the foresight to get a, you know, a travel agent's preloaded card with Canadian dollars on it and all the rest of it, would have been screaming blue murder at the loss of purchasing power of his sterling. It was fine for me because I just spent off my gold money card while you know, gold was up so far against sterling. And when sterling recovered a bit more and gold went down a little bit more, I started spending off my bank debit card.
Yeah.
And playing those two together was a fascinating experience. And I reckon I saved myself probably well over $1,000 by just playing those two, you know, the two different currencies. Gold and sterling. So that is, I think, a very good example of how you can actually use a preloaded card, which preloads out of gold. You just, you know, I mean, you preload it the night before, you know, then you go and spend it. If, on the other hand, you think, well, gold is too low, I'm not going to do that, I'll spend it off my ordinary debit card. It's amazing how much money you actually make by effectively trading your money that way.
Yeah. That's a brilliant selling point, Alistair. And again, just argues as to why this is such a great deal and why I'm sure it's going to continue to grow. The only things I have to ask you next probably all have to deal with that growth and to manage a company that's growing that fast. David is just wondering, he bought 10 grams vaulted in Singapore, and is just curious, how do you fully allocate something as small as 10 grams? And then as he accumulates more, in what form is the physical stored? Anyway, that's the first question.
Right. Okay. Well, the answer to this is quite simple. The allocation is done by computer. So in effect, we don't actually hold a separate little bar of 10 grams for you. But what you have is a share, if you like, in a 1 kilo bar, or it may be a 400 ounce bar. You know, it's standard gold, which is deliverable. That's the whole point. If you want to have your 10 grams delivered, then we can arrange that. It won't be exactly the same 10 grams that you know.
I understand.
We're not going to chop it out of a 1 kilo bar, but you know, it is there. It's yours. It's audited, and we have a continual running audit on it. So that's basically the way it works. I mean, you know, it's amazing with financial technology what you can do with gold. You can bring it back to life as a spending mechanism, and that's effectively what we've done.
That makes sense to me. Carl has noticed, he's a longtime gold money customer, but he seems like there's lost some live support there by phone or by chat. Any response to that?
I honestly don't know. I'm not involved with that side of things at all. I just sort of do research. I will report back that point. It's a loss of sort of live chat contacts and so on and so forth.
Okay. Eric,
is that right? No,
yeah. That apparently, I don't know if that's been eliminated or what, but
I don't think so. I think it's a question. They're probably just different channels. We've gone through quite a lot of change in this company.
Right.
So, I know there are sort of live chat, rooms and all the rest of it, but I never use them. I should do. So I'm not really au fait with it. But I will report that. I'll report that back to the company and say that it was a point that was made.
There you go.
If I get an answer, I'll come back to you with that, and then you can send it on.
Thank you. Eric's question is: says there's a lag right now transferring between BitGold gold savings to the BitGold credit card. Last time he did it, there was like a day, maybe even more. Do you know anything about that process? That preload lag, is it smoothing out?
It's a funny one. I don't sort of get involved in the mechanics of it, but when I've used it, I've been surprised that I can actually load my card over a weekend when markets are shut. I don't know if it's always like that. I don't know. Sometimes I think it is. It's partly a question of sort of when markets are trading and when they're not trading and so on. I think that is an effect. I don't know whether our dealing engine, if you like, my guess is it probably tries to match buyers and sellers first before it goes into the market. But you shouldn't really have very much of a delay. I'm surprised it's as much as a day.
Okay.
Do you know whether it was at a particular time or?
He didn't say. Maybe he'll throw that in here at the end. But speaking of time, Eric says he'll try again. It might have been a one-time thing. And the issue on the customer support was with Gold Money Personal. So, Lastly, it is now. Hold on. It is. Speaking of time, we've been at this for an hour, so we better shut her down just out of respect for your time. Because as I look at my clock, it's probably 6 o'clock where you are, right?
Yeah, it's about time for whiskey and soda.
Well, exactly. I'm infringing upon your happy hour and your cocktail hour, so I apologize.
That's no problem, really.
extraordinarily valuable, and I'll be sending it over to my contacts in the marketing department at Gold Money so that they can put it up on their side as well, so we get as much bang out of this as we can. But before we wrap, you know what the tradition is. I got to ask you the final four. So
go on.
If you're ready, can I lay them on you?
Yes, go for it.
Okay, Alistair. You're an Englishman, obviously. When was the last time you had fish and chips?
Well, actually, I'm a Scotsman. Proud of it.
I apologize, you're a Scot. Gosh darn it, I didn't want to lump you in with those nasty Englishmen.
And the answer to the question is last week.
Last week? There you go.
Yep.
Right. It very much is.
I'm trying to remember which day it was. I think it was Friday night, actually.
Delicious. All right. The Olympics have been going on now for almost 2 weeks. Which is your favorite Olympic sport to watch?
Oh, dear, oh, dear. I like sailing because I sail. And I used to race. Not at that level. But unfortunately, it's actually quite a difficult sport, if you like, to cover from the television point of view. But that's what I like to watch. But having said that, I've seen things which I never thought I'd have any interest in at all because Britain has done so incredibly well.
Yeah.
Things like, the cycling, and the gymnastics. Gymnastics never turned me on at all. But suddenly I find myself sort of, transfixed about it. There's a wonderful American girl who, with her floor exercises, she's just amazing. Absolutely amazing. And then, the cycling. which to me has always been a very boring thing, you know, suddenly it really got quite exciting. We got so many gold medals out of it. I'm just absolutely amazed.
Yes. I got to tell you, though, personally, my favorite is women's beach volleyball. We'll just leave it at that. all right. Number three.
You're younger than me, I think.
I find it thrilling to watch. All right. Number three. Speaking of the Olympics, which would be a better 2024 venue for the Olympics? You know, they're going to go to Tokyo and all get irradiated in 4 years. And then after that, I guess we're down to L.A., Paris, and Rome. Which do you think would be better?
I think probably Rome.
I like it.
Now, the reason I would say Rome is I just love Italy. I know, I love France too, but, you know, Paris is boring, really. Rome is great. And I think, I mean, the food would be fantastic. And, I mean, I would just, if I was going to the Olympics, I think I would probably have a week on either side just to really enjoy, you know, going to places like Florence, maybe going to Capri, the Amalfi Coast. Oh, it's just absolute heaven. So, in a sense, I'm actually going not for the Olympics, but because it will be Rome.
Exactly. All right. And finally, a kind of a new twist on an old question. If you had about, I'd say, 5,200 Federal Reserve notes in your possession at this moment, and we're talking, let's put a time frame on this. This is going to be a 16-month holding period. Are you going to buy? You have two choices. You could either buy 4 ounces of gold, or you could buy 100 shares of the GDXJ. Which would you prefer?
I don't know what the GDXJ is.
Oh, I'm sorry. That GDXJ is that junior gold miners ETF that trades here in the
States. All right. Okay. That's a good question. Do you know, I think I'd probably go for the GDXJ, basically because I would see it as a punt, and I've got quite a lot of gold and silver anyway.
Good point. Oh, shoot, Alistair, that sure was fun. And I just can't tell you on the behalf of everybody here in the TFMR community how much we appreciate you being so generous with your time, because this was just fabulous. It seems almost like yesterday we were talking about LIBOR because we've been going at it for so long. But that just is a fascinating subject. And again, I encourage everybody to read the link to what Alistair just posted here on Thursday, but also to keep following along at goldmoney.com, where Alistair's head of research, and also the stuff he posts at financeandeconomics.org. Alistair, just great. Thank you so much. And I suppose we're probably going to want to check in with you again sooner rather than later. So hopefully we can do this again in a few months.
That would be very much my pleasure, Craig.
All right, my friend, and to everybody out there listening, thanks again for playing along, and we'll have another A to A soon.